In September 1961, under circumstances that have never really been explained, a plane carrying the Secretary-General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, crashed in Zambia, killing everyone aboard. The Security Council chose as his successor an almost unknown Burmese diplomat who, in the 60s, became a mighty figure in the world. U Thant drove decolonisation, challenged Washington over Vietnam, worked with great skill to contain conflicts from Kashmir to the Congo, and played a little-known but vital role in resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis. His grandson, Thant Mino, thought it was time to celebrate his grandfather, who's largely disappeared from history, hence the biography he has written, Peacemaker, U Thant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World. Academic, historian, author of 5 books on the history of Burma, a man who has helped lead reform efforts in Myanmar, Thant Minh U joins me now from the UK. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, I have to start with that photograph of you as a little boy in your grandfather's arms, flanked by Apollo 11 astronauts after their mission to the moon. What on earth was happening?
He was very keen on space exploration. So he met with all of the different, not just astronauts, but cosmonauts as well, over those years. And I remember, I must have been 3 years old at the time, woken up to watch the moon landing in his bedroom on the big Zenith color TV. And this was many months later when the Apollo 11 astronauts came to the UN and came to see him. And they gave the UN a moon rock, which is still at the UN. And I don't remember meeting them per se, but I remember going to his office that day. I remember when that photo was taken, because the thing that impressed me the most were not the astronauts who had just come back from the moon, but the big map behind with blinking lights, which I was always attracted to as a four-year-old, I think, at the
blinking
time.
Blinking lights are a winner every time, aren't they? Let's start with your grandfather's early life. He was born in what was known then as Burma.
Yeah, that's right. It was part of the British Empire. Burma was then a province of India, just like the Punjab or Bengal. He was from a well-to-do family that suddenly became impoverished when he was 15. So he had to give up all his hopes of finishing university. And instead, he decided after just a couple of years at university to quit and come back to this little town. It was university in Rangoon, which was a day's steamer ride away, to come back to this little town and to teach in the local school. And he became headmaster. And that way he was able to look after his younger brothers and his mother as well. And he stayed there until he was nearly 40 years old. He was really interested in the rest of the world. He was reading every book, magazine, newspaper he could get a hold of. He mastered English himself, but he was in this little town that was very remote, even by Burmese standards. And at nearly age 40, he decided to leave, midlife career change, went to Rangoon, joined government service, and within 10 years, he found himself living in Midtown Manhattan as Burma's new ambassador to the UN.
Dag Hammarskjöld was a huge figure. How did this obscure man from Burma come to succeed him?
Yeah, you know, because the UN, it was set up originally in 1945. It was meant to be this, you know, 5 policemen of the world, the US, the Russians, the British, they were all going to work together. And it didn't happen because of the Cold War. And the UN was kind of stuck for a few years in a way. And it was Dag Hammarskjöld who pioneered this idea of the UN Secretary General being the world's mediator and solving conflicts. And something else that was happening at the same time was that many countries, dozens of countries in Asia and Africa, were becoming independent. They called themselves the Afro-Asians of the UN. They were becoming the biggest bloc of countries at the UN by 1961. And at the height of the Cold War, you know, with the Americans and the Soviets facing off in Berlin in this crisis in the Congo, they decided, we can't leave everything in the hands of just Washington and Moscow. We have to take the helm of the UN. We have to have one of our own at the helm of the UN. And they pushed people like Nehru in India, Nkrumah in Ghana, for an Afro-Asian candidate. And Burma was at that time a neutral country, so that was helpful. And my grandfather, over those few years since he arrived in New York, had developed a reputation as a skillful diplomat and someone who just got on with everyone. And so I think that pushed him over, over the line in terms of getting support from the Americans as well as the Afro-Asians, countries like Sweden, Ireland. The Russians were not too sure about him. They didn't really know, but they agreed in the end. But because of the Russians, he was on probation for the first year as acting Secretary General.
But the French thought he was too short.
Yeah, he was 5'7", almost 5'8", which wasn't actually very short in those days, about the same as people like, say, Harold Wilson in Britain. But yeah, they said they were musing amongst themselves that maybe he was too short. And more importantly for them, he didn't speak French at all. And he replied to the journalist who mentioned this, that he was taller than Napoleon, who didn't even speak English.
What did it mean that he was a Buddhist?
I think Buddhism was very important to him, but it was also quite a personal thing. So it meant less. I mean, in New York, he couldn't be involved in any Buddhist ceremonies or anything like that, going to monasteries or pagodas, things that he might have done in Burma with family. It was more of a personal sort of view of the world. And I think he really valued above anything else sort of calm-headedness, people who stayed calm under pressure, who had a grip on their own sort of inner thoughts and feelings and emotions. It was a kind of a stoicism in a way. It also gave him a very sort of ethical view of the world. And it was always a work in progress. I think he always tried really hard under very difficult circumstances over those years to try to improve his Buddhism, his sense, you know, these kind of Buddhist ideas that all things are impermanent, that life is about change, that you have to be tolerant. All these things, I think, were things that he and my grandmother, who is in some ways even a more devout Buddhist, constantly reminded him about. He saw his role more as, you know, the person who had to be available to fix things and try things quietly from behind the scenes first. And it was only reluctantly that he, you know, goes forward and does these things like challenge Lyndon Johnson on Vietnam.
Yes, you don't do that lightly.
No, but he got away with it, which is the amazing thing, right? He got away with it for you. I mean, imagine now, you know, future UN Secretary General standing up and basically, you know, condemning Donald Trump or something. He wouldn't last 5 minutes in that job.
It'll come. It'll come. What did it do to the United Nations? I mean, you've already mentioned one example. I mean, the election of U Thant himself, but how did the United Nations change as all of these former colonies became states and became members of the UN?
Yeah, they were already beginning to transform the UN because they embraced the charter. They actually gave meaning to the human rights aspects of the charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They had come out of decades of fighting colonialism. They wanted to make anti-racism a very important thing at the UN. They wanted to complete decolonization, and they wanted to complete decolonization in a way that independence was genuine and real. It wasn't just a piece of paper that London or Paris or the British or the French would give them, but that it meant that they were part of an international system in which they were treated equally to the Europeans, the Americans, and the others. And I think U Thant felt the same way, and he would lead this fight for decolonization. And one of the first things he did, the thing that changed, and the thing that was very different from Hammarskjöld, was Hammarskjöld in the Congo, which is a very complex crisis, but it was essentially about kind of independence and what that meant. Hammarskjöld was looking for a compromise, and he died actually trying to find a ceasefire or negotiate a ceasefire. But U Thant took a much tougher line in support of the Congo government and against this breakaway province that was being propped up by the Belgians and by white supremacist networks in southern Africa. So he took a much tougher line and actually unleashed or wanted to unleash the UN peacekeeping force there against to fight the mercenaries that had come in from South Africa and elsewhere.
Is that what happened in the end? Was that how that hideous situation was resolved?
Yeah, absolutely. So he had trouble in the beginning because the British were trying to hold him back. The British were, the Conservative government or members of Conservative MPs were actually, many of them were shareholders in the mining companies that were going to do well in this breakaway province. So the government of Harold Macmillan was trying to hold him back. And he spent many months trying to get around this European pressure by building up good relations with Kennedy as well as with Khrushchev, who was the Soviet leader. And in 63, he did give a green light to what was called Operation Grand Slam, where several thousand UN troops, the first and only real UN army under a UN Secretary General with its own air force. They were Swedes, Irishmen, Ghanaians, Indians, with a big Indian armored brigade at the center, took on thousands of South African, British, Rhodesian, French, Belgian, white supremacist mercenaries and defeated them. And that was the end of the Congo secession in 1963.
By that time, though, your grandfather had played an important but I found fascinating role in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, what was he doing there? What was it that he managed to pull off?
I think the tradition, you know, what people learn in schools or might have seen in a movie is that the Russians put missiles in Cuba and Kennedy blockades the island. Soviet ships are still coming towards the blockade line. The world is on the brink of a nuclear war. And somehow, because the Americans stand tough, the Russians back down. That's kind of the story that we...
Yeah, that's the standard explanation. Kennedy held firm.
Yeah, exactly. And what none of these stories mention is that there was a Burmese UN Secretary General who was the mediator that made the de-escalation of the crisis possible. And so he sent a series, and people will see in the book, it's a really complicated story with late night phone calls from the White House to him and everything else, sent a series of both public messages and secret communications that essentially understood that this was a political crisis, not a military crisis. And he had to find or do the dance at the UN that he had to do, find a way to give Khrushchev and Kennedy the political space and the time they needed to climb down in their own ways and satisfy their own constituencies. So it's with Khrushchev, for example, it was much easier to respond positively to an appeal for peace from a UN Secretary General than it was to respond to an ultimatum from an American president. For Kennedy as well, he saw many different ways in which Uthant's diplomacy was useful. And at one stage in the crisis, Uthant had both senior US and Soviet delegations just outside his office on the 38th floor of the UN in different rooms, shuttling between the two to try to hammer out a verification agreement once the overall framework of which was his idea in the beginning, of trading the removal of Soviet missiles for an American pledge not to invade Cuba had already been more or less agreed. He also flew to Havana in the middle of the crisis to placate Fidel Castro, who still at that point could have done many things to tip the crisis over into war. And he spent a couple of days with Fidel.
Did those three leaders, Castro, Khrushchev, Kennedy, acknowledge his role?
Yeah, because, you know, when I started working on this, I thought, you know, it's kind of a forgotten thing. I was looking in the archives, saw lots of things that had never been written up, even in sort of scholarly works or very, very little. And I thought maybe I'm over, you know, thinking about this or seeing things that's not there. And I looked at the newspapers at that time, and he was on the front page every single day. So the New York Times, he was in the headline, Kennedy accepts Thant's plan, you know, Thant about to fly to Cuba, all these things. And so it wasn't, I mean, his role was acknowledged at the time. And at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think for the first and probably last time, the US and Soviet governments both together signed a letter of appreciation. And Kennedy in public said, Uthant has put the world in his debt because of what he did to de-escalate the Cuban Missile Crisis.
What was he able to do about atomic testing? This, I gather, you know, from what you write, he detested the bomb.
Yeah, he was pretty fervent in his belief that it was crazy for the world to have nuclear weapons because it was just going to be a matter of time before they were going to be used again. And it wasn't just him. The Afro-Asians, the non-aligned countries were also had been pushing very hard for disarmament. That was at the top of the UN agenda. And it was in that context that the Americans and the Soviets negotiated the first non-proliferation or nuclear test ban treaty. It was a nuclear test ban treaty in 1964. And he went to the signing with Khrushchev and others in Moscow in the summer of that year. But he continued to talk a lot about the danger of nuclear war And he was particularly worried, I think, through the 60s that the Americans would be tempted to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam in the same way that they had been tempted to use them in Korea a decade before.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Thant Minh U, the grandson of U Thant, the first non-Western UN Secretary General. He prided himself on not being a radical, and yet everything about his sort of bigger political ambitions suggests a man who was indeed radical.
He was radical in many ways, and he said to the Americans, actually, in the early 60s, I think it was, that they shouldn't be afraid of radical change in Asia. He was an anti-communist at home, so he had no desire to see, you know, communist governments come to power in Asia. But by radical, I think he meant that these countries in Asia and Africa, the newly independent countries, wanted radical change. They wanted to develop. They wanted to catch up with the West. They wanted social progress. They wanted change from you know, the state of their societies under colonial rule. So he was radical in that way. And then I think he thought, you know, in the same way that many others, I think, who had founded the UN believed as well, that after two world wars, 80 million people dead, a Great Depression in between, atomic weapons in the, you know, hundreds or thousands by that time in the hands of the Soviets and the Americans, that there had to be a completely different vision of international politics, that we just couldn't go back to the, you know, look back to the 19th century, early 20th century for ideas. We had to make a different international system that was based on the UN Charter. I think he believed that, and I think he understood that that would take radical change, not just in terms of, you know, specific policies, but in terms of how people thought about the world at the time as well, and their places as not just citizens of, you know, patriots, American patriots, Russian patriots, citizens of different countries, but also as people living on this planet. And that, you know, we also had to have this sort of shared sense that the planet needed protecting as well in many different ways.
Do we look at his efforts around the Vietnam War as really a failure on his part to achieve anything worthwhile?
It was a failure of the UN in a way, because one could say that a lot of things that were happening in Vietnam were violations of the UN Charter. He had no mandate, so the Security Council, which should have or could have perhaps acted, didn't. And without a mandate, the Secretary General is essentially sort of powerless. He just has a sort of moral authority. But despite that, for many, many years, he tried tirelessly to try to find a way out for the Americans, essentially. And that included, as people see my book, you know, sort of secret diplomacy between the North Vietnamese and the Americans, or attempts at that. And also, increasingly, publicly challenging the American way of thinking about Vietnam. And this is what really upset people like President Lyndon Johnson, with whom he had a very strange relationship, because he was saying to the Americans, look, this is not about, it's domino theory is a fiction. This is not about the Chinese taking over Vietnam. The Vietnamese have no desire to be under the Chinese or anybody else. They just want to be on their own 2 feet. They want their country reunified. The more this can be done in a negotiated way, better the chance that the South Vietnamese will escape communism, or at least, you know, the harsher types of communism that could come to the country. And a peacefully reunified Vietnam is not a threat to anyone. And you can use me and I can help you in trying to make that happen. So this is what he was saying. He said the Vietnamese feel that they're in a fight for independence, first against the French and then against the Americans. And if the Americans try for a military solution, and he said this as early as 63, 64, they will lose. And he said to the Americans privately, you will lose this war, and it will be a disaster for Americans, and it will be a disaster for the world. Because if we go back to that time in 64, he had just mediated the Cuban Missile Crisis. The UN was flying high. The Soviets had kind of mellowed out under Khrushchev. They and the Americans under Kennedy, and even Johnson early on, wanted to work with the UN. He thought many things were going to be possible in terms of development, all kinds of cooperation. And then Vietnam happened. So I think he knew from the beginning that an American war in Vietnam would be, not just in terms of the countless kind of, you know, people dying, being killed, all the atrocities that happened, but it was going to be a disaster for global peace.
And all this time, he was in a way, inventing the role of the Secretary General. That it was, as you mentioned a moment ago, it was not an office that had any particular power to it, except what he could bring to it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the charter just says Secretary General is the head of the organization, and the only power it gives him in or her, maybe in the future, under Article 99, is this person can bring to the attention of the Security Council anything that he thinks might be a threat to global, to international peace and security. And so implicit in that is that he has some role. He's not just the kind of manager of the office that organizes the conferences and things, that he has some kind of political role. And it's based on that Hammarskjöld first and then Uthant, over 10 years, really tried to develop that political role of the Secretary General. But in the end, he has no specific power. Again, it's the moral authority of the office, and his ability to constantly develop and maintain also relationships with the top leader. So in a way that we don't see anymore, and we haven't for a long time, he would see, you know, the Soviet leader like Brezhnev one day, Charles de Gaulle the next day, hop over to London and see Harold Wilson, go back to America and see Lyndon Johnson. And he was in touch with dozens of other leaders from around the world. So on any issue, I think he had to develop, and this was his kind of superpower, in a sense of empathy, you know, a sense of what everyone was thinking and where the openings might be for diplomacy and for a UN role on any potential threat. I mean, not just Vietnam, but on any potential issue that was facing the organization.
And it depended on trust.
It depended on an ability of, well, two things. One is, I think, on the leaders of these governments to believe that the UN was not just this kind of idealistic set of abstract ideas, let's all work together and hope for the best, but a really practical machine, right? A machine where of Uthant and senior diplomats around him that were working for him, really some of the top mediators in the world, that they could help to find a solution if there was a problem in a conflict in crisis in Cyprus, a conflict in Kashmir, a conflict between the Dutch and the Indonesians over Papua, anything it was, anything that there might have been, that there was this UN machinery that they could turn to. I think they had to have certain confidence in that. But I think Uthant and his lieutenants also had to constantly prove themselves by actually delivering and bringing about different ceasefires and then building on those successes to try to use this growing kind of UN authority in different ways as well.
What languages did he speak?
Only Burmese and English. So Burmese is his mother tongue. But his dad was an interesting figure, and he was a businessman. He was educated partly in Calcutta in India, and he had a Victorian library, a library of Victorian Edwardian books at home. So my grandfather learned some English at school, but then mastered English himself. He didn't speak any other language. By reading Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle and all kinds of different books.
Wonderful.
As a little kid, 8, 9, 10 years old. Yeah.
He fell out rather with the Brits and the Americans towards the end of his time as Secretary General. What was that about?
It was Vietnam. It was mainly Vietnam. I mean, I think we have to, you know, go back to that time. And Vietnam was the central, other than kind of overall U.S.-Soviet relations, but that had been kind of improving. Vietnam was the central issue, right? And it was the American central national security issue. And he challenged that as this person who, you know, from Burma, and he had fallen out with the Burmese government as well. He was just this lone guy on the 38th floor at the top of the UN building, challenging the whole US national security establishment on its war in Vietnam. And I think the British, for different reasons, didn't want to, we see this in different times in British history, didn't want to go up against the Americans on what was their big issue. So they also had a feeling that Uthant was being soft on the communist side. And I think they made themselves feel that way to some extent because they wanted to please the Americans at that time.
But Thant, at least the British stayed out of the fighting. The Australians went, dived in our way. We like to join America in its wars. Can it be said that Uthant did any particular good for Australia?
That's a good question, because Australia was, you know, really important in the founding of the UN. It was one of the countries that really pushed for the idea that it shouldn't just be about the big powers, but that small states should also have a role and try to make the role of the General Assembly, where every country has a representative and an equal vote, bigger. And Australia, you know, has a big contribution to peacekeeping as well. But I think the UN's role for Australia is something different, which is, you know, I think we have to understand that the UN in the 50s, 60s, 70s was essential in creating the international system that we have today. The international system that we have today wasn't just sort of thought up by a couple of, you know, few Americans and Brits and Russians. It was the result of these fights by a lot of these countries to have this more equitable system, to infuse it with all these ideas in the UN Charter. And it's been imperfect. There have been lots of UN failures as well as successes. But, you know, its central aim, by far, its central aim was to prevent World War III. And we haven't had World War III since 1945. And I think you look at the UN, it's a bit like, you know, in a house, you have this old wall and it looks damaged and doesn't look so great anymore. But it's a load-bearing wall. And so much else that we have in the international system that has made the last many decades of peace and prosperity possible is because of the UN, I think. And not just as a piece of paper, but as, you know, the result of these efforts over those initial decades to make it something meaningful.
There's another photograph in the book, your grandfather's retirement party, and some extraordinary guests.
Yeah, he was retiring at the end of 1971, and yeah, there was a big party thrown for him. It was a lunch at the Pierre Hotel in New York. It was a cold, sort of rainy day. And 600 people, many of the usual suspects, diplomats, UN officials, but also all these celebrities, people who had fundraised for the party, included people like Jackie Kennedy. It included all these top business people from places like Chase Manhattan Bank, but also groups like the Amalgamated Laundry Workers of New York, showing you that the trades unions were also really important in supporting the UN at the time. But all these celebrities like Buckminster Fuller, Arnold Toynbee, Joan Baez, Cesar Chavez, they had all written in with these messages. And at the party itself, there were all these celebrities as well, like Jacques Cousteau, for example. And Pete Seeger was meant to sing the music for the party. So Uthant gives this big speech. He says, we all need to be thinking of ourselves as planetary citizens. They all declare him planetary citizen number one. And John Lennon's there with Yoko Ono. He passes Pete Seeger a little note. Pete Seeger gives John Lennon a guitar. And John Lennon says, you know, you wouldn't have heard this song before because I've never sung it in the US. And he sings Imagine for the first time in America.
Uthant, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I've been talking to Uthant Min Oo, who has written A Life of His Grandfather, the great leader of the United Nations, Uthant. The book is called Peacemaker, Uthant and the Forgotten Quest for a Just World, published by Norton. This is Late Night Live.